Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Stephanie, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Living with Prostate Cancer, and this is a three-part series, and today's program is entitled Into Understanding the Molecular Portrait of Prostate Cancer. It's a very important program today. We're starting it off with this basic understanding of the molecular portrait of prostate cancer, and today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and a number of other cancer organizations, and it really is because of that collaboration that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. We have over 722 participants on the call today, and you come from all over the United States, from all different parts of this country, and we also have international participants from Canada and the United Kingdom, so it's really a bit of an international call as well. And we kind of want to applaud all of you for being on this call. Today's program has been made possible by educational grants from Genomic Health, Inc., Janssen Services, LLC, and the Safeway Foundation. I really want to thank them for their corporate collaboration in making today's program possible. Now, you have received from Cancer Care some materials about the call. I just want to go over those with you. In the materials, you have information about our speakers and the topics they'll be covering. And you also have information about all the different collaborating organizations as a resource. And there is an evaluation form. And I would ask you all to take a moment at the end of the call today and complete that evaluation form. When you think about it, who but each of you can best actually tell us the programs we should be offering. This is the beginning of a new year. We're planning lots of programs. And your suggestions really help us to make these programs more relevant to your needs. Indeed, the topics for this three-part series were ones that you have asked us to do, and so we try very hard to implement your suggestions. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Susan Slovin. And Dr. Slovin is Associate Attending Physician, Genitourinary Oncology Service, Sidney Kimmel Center for Prostate and Urologic Diseases, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. She's also Associate Professor of Medicine, Department of Medicine, Weill College of Cornell University. And Dr. Slovin is a frequent presenter on our programs and indeed the recipient of Cancer Care's Physician of the Year Award. And Dr. Slovin is going to cover an overview of prostate cancer, including current standard of care, the role of surgery and radiation oncology, managing side effects and pain, and new treatment approaches in clinical trials. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Slovin.
Thank you, Carolyn, and good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I always tell Carolyn I'm never sure that I'm going to be able to get through everything in such a short period of time, and if I don't, please feel free to phone in some questions, and we'll try to address all your needs. So I have the pleasure of having Dr. Philip Febbo with me today, who will be addressing really the molecular profiling of prostate cancer, and we're going to be more or less speaking in tandem, mainly because it's really important to set the stage about the adversary that people face, which is prostate cancer. I am more than pleased to say that within the last year, or probably more than that, we have so many new drugs that are out there, and it's become very exciting because we really are making a difference in how patients are dealing with their disease and how they're coping. So as everybody, I'm sure, already knows that upon the diagnosis of prostate cancer, which could be made either by an abnormal digital examination, meaning feeling an abnormality within the prostate itself, a lump, a bump, or even a hard prostate, or if a marker in the blood known as prostate-specific antigen, PSA, is abnormally high, that often leads to a diagnosis of prostate cancer. And please keep in mind that PSA elevation per se is not diagnostic for prostate cancer. Sexual relations within 48 hours of having a PSA drawn could be cause of an elevated PSA, infection such as prostatitis, which is an inflammation of the prostate, could also do it. And you really have to have a sort of Tour de France cycling in order to have an elevated PSA. But that's just to give you an idea of really the causes. Now, upon diagnosis, the standards of care still remain surgery versus radiation, and the survival between both of them are comparable. For certain patients who may have very significant medical problems, expectant monitoring, or what we call really active surveillance, is usually a reasonable option. When we talk about active surveillance, it is indeed active, and that means that if you're not going to treat the cancer, then one needs to be followed closely by a urologist to get a sense of how fast the PSAs may be rising. Are they doubling or tripling, meaning that you have to do something immediately, or is it going up very slowly? In addition, there are what we call saturation biopsies, or biopsies that are done at much higher core volume, meaning instead of the routine 12-core biopsy, 18 or 24 cores of tissue may be taken just to make sure that no new areas of disease are found. Bone and CAT scan could be done, MRI with endorectal probe, which are imaging modalities that are used often for diagnosis, can be done at specified intervals. But the most important thing if you do active surveillance is that you must be followed closely. It's not going to the urologist and saying, see you next year. You really need to be followed closely. The decision to go for surgery is very individual, obviously. This should be discussed with your healthcare provider. And please remember that any intervention really is something that needs to be discussed with a partner or loved one because it is a disease of the couple. Surgery, is the standard therapy for years, has been open radical prostatectomy. And more recently, there have been improvements in the area such that either laparoscopic or robotic surgeries are now being done. The difference between laparoscopic and open radical prostatectomy is that four little incisions are made, two on the left lower quadrant, two on the right, and the prostate is actually delivered through a tiny incision through the belly button, and all you need is some Band-Aids. And the benefit, really, it's the same surgery as if this were open radical, but this means that the patient is usually out of the hospital sometimes the same day or within 24 hours. Similarly, robotic surgery, which is now the Da Vinci robot, as everybody may hear it be called, is the same. It's really a laparoscopic approach, but the comfort level for the surgeon is very different. The surgeon is sitting at a robotic station and is able to manipulate the hands of an instrument, if you will, called the robot, with a higher magnification, and perform the same surgery, the same removal of lymph nodes, the same removal of seminal vesicles and other structures as it would be if you didn't open radical. If the PSA following surgery should be down to zero, and there may be perhaps the same amount of urinary incontinence or stress incontinence for several months, but that usually abates, and erectile function is usually preserved. Should surgery not be your option, then there is radiation therapy. You may hear about external beam or intensity modulated radiation, which has been the standard for many years, but in certain patients who have relatively unaggressive cancers, seed implants or what we call brachytherapy or interstitial implants, they're all the same, are what can be recommended and usually pretty well tolerated. You may hear in the literature about proton beam. There are a number of major medical centers that use proton beam radiation. One of the interests about proton beam is the thought that the distance to normal structures may be less, thereby obliterating any scatter radiation that could affect normal or very closely aligned structures. And indeed, that's one of its major important aspects, particularly in pediatric malignancies such as brain tumors, is that it doesn't go very deeply into neighboring structures. However, while this proton beam has been used, we really don't have data to say that it's any better than the good old-fashioned external beam radiation therapy. CyberKnife is also a variant of that. We don't have enough data to compare it with the standard of radiation, so you hear a lot about it. And again, decision of the type of radiation should be discussed with your caretaker. I often tell patients who are feeling somewhat that they're victimized by the bias of a radiation oncologist or a urologist should often go to a medical oncologist. Dr. Febo is one, I'm one, and the reason is it gives you an unbiased view of really what might be the best way of handling your disease, meaning that we would provide you with education to help you make that right decision that only you can make. Now, assuming that everybody does well for a while, there are patients, of course, whose cancers are not held in check by radiation or surgery, and they may develop what we call a biochemical relapse, which means that the PSA has returned after a very long period of time. It could be months or years. And there is no standard of care for the patient who has a biochemical relapse, meaning the only manifestation of the disease is a rising PSA. Patients could go on hormonal therapy, which suppresses the man's ability to have erections by virtue of preventing testosterone from being made. One could consider investigational or clinical trials. My own feeling is that clinical trials are always important, particularly at the early part of disease relapse, because that could help change what we hope will be the biology of the cancer. If the cancer comes back in the form of metastatic disease, in addition to a rising PSA, but something that can be seen in the bone or lymph node, the standard of care is hormonal therapy. And again, patients could go on and off this kind of therapy. For patients who have been on hormonal therapy and then become resistant, we know from experience and in the literature that we can often use different kinds of combination therapies because the cancer, if it doesn't respond to one combination of hormones, may respond to different combinations of hormonal therapy. So in that setting, there are also immunologic therapies such as Cipolucil-T from the Dendrion Corporation. It's a cellular product immunotherapy that's made with the patient's own cells to target a particular molecule called prostate-specific membrane antigen, and this has been well tolerated and has had some favorable responses. If hormones no longer work or the cancer is progressing too fast, and you know, one does not have to go on to chemotherapy emergently. My own indications for people to go on to other hormonal therapies or even chemotherapy is really based on, number one, how fast is their PSA rising? Is it doubling or tripling no matter what I do? Number two, is the patient not thriving? Is that patient just feeling sickly and not eating and just doesn't have that energy? And number three, do they have so much disease that I would have to give radiation to multiple sites in order to control the disease? And in these situations, sometimes chemotherapy is the best one to use. The standard chemotherapy that's used in prostate cancer is called docetaxel or Taxotere. It's given every 3 weeks by an infusion into the vein, and this has had a very favorable impact for patients. Within the last 2 years, we have been very fortunate to have a second-line chemotherapy that's been FDA-approved for patients who have failed docetaxel or Taxotere. It's called cabazitaxel or Gemtana, and this, too, has had very favorable responses in patients who have failed primary chemotherapy. We, again, have been very successful in the fact that post-chemotherapy, whether it's docetaxel or cabazitaxel, we can use new hormonal agents. One agent that has been out there that was recently approved is called enzalutamide, or Xtandi, X-T-A-N-D-I, and another one called abiraterone, or Zytiga. Now, they're both what we call androgen receptor targeted therapy, and Dr. Febo will talk a little bit about that at some point. But it's to give you an idea is that androgen targeted therapy are now the new medications. This is the androgen receptor is a molecule on the tumor cell to which testosterone, the male hormone that really stimulates the growth of the cell, binds. And these two new drugs, which are oral agents, they are not chemotherapy, but they are variants of hormonal therapy, although they work a little differently than one another, will target this androgen receptor and can cause the tumor cells to regress or be under better control. So while we have in our armamentarium all these new drugs, we still often ask ourselves, what do we do when patients have a fair amount of pain as a result of their cancer continuing to grow? Sometimes we see mixed responses. Certain areas in bone or lymph glands will have gone away, and new areas pop up. And when you start to see that and patients have pain, standard treatments could include radiation therapy or a new drug that will likely be approved in several months, known as Rad-223 or Radium-223. The other name for it is Alpha-Radin. It is a novel radiopharmaceutical, very similar to one that's already been approved called Samarium-153 or Quadramet, but the benefit of this particular intravenous infusion is that it can be redosed or given on multiple occasions and has also been shown to be very favorable in terms of its side effect profile. Among the new drugs that are out there now, there is cabozantinib, which is another targeted agent against a particular pathway that is important in prostate cancer growth. So I guess, you know, probably the best way to talk about all this is that we have so many new drugs that are out there that After a while, I think we have to sit down very carefully and try to figure out how to position these drugs, knowing whether we can give it earlier or later in the disease. Do we give it alone? Do we give it in combination? So this is just a very small capsule, but I think the most important takeaway message is that we have new drugs that are out there. We are learning the best time to give them. We also know that keeping your bones strong is extremely important, and that agents such as zoledronic acid or Zometa or Xgeva or denosumab, which are bone strengthening agents, should be used at the discretion of your medical oncologist in terms of keeping those bones really strong and preventing any events that could cause you more pain. So with that rather brief introduction, I'm going to go back to you, Carolyn. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Slovin, and that really was an outstanding introduction and presentation on a lot, very informative about prostate cancer and its treatment and all the new treatments that are out there as well. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. And our next speaker is Dr. Philip Febbo. And Dr. Febbo is a professor of medicine and urology, Department of Medicine, Hematology Oncology, UCSF, and he's leader of prostate cancer program at UCSF Helen Diller Family Comprehensive Cancer Center. And Dr. Febbo is going to be addressing really some very interesting areas that I think we all want to learn much more about, and he's going to talk about innovations in biomarker testing and molecular profiling of prostate cancer, emerging diagnostic technologies, the role of personalized medicine in improving treatment decisions, and communicating with your healthcare team. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Febbo.
Oh, thank you, and thank you for inviting me to participate. This is my first event with you, and I'm excited to complement what Susan has presented. You know, Susan gave an outstanding overview of the diagnosis and localized treatment and treatment of metastatic prostate cancer. And I'm going to focus more on how we understand prostate cancer from a molecular and genetic level. But I think a very important point to make at the beginning is that whereas Susan and I agreed to talk about these separately, in the future they will be integral together to, just like Susan said, to understand each man's prostate cancer from a molecular and genetic level so that we can use the growing list of therapies we have to improve their outcome and to minimize the suffering due to prostate cancer. So thinking about prostate cancer, cancer is a genetic disease, meaning that prostate cells, which start off with a normal DNA that is the same as every place in your body, somehow over time that DNA gets changed and mutations occur or other alterations that result in the cell, an epithelial cell, which normally would divide a couple times, what we call differentiate, turn into a functional prostate epithelial cell. And then at some point, the prostate epithelial cell should just go undergo a natural cell death and others would replace it. Well, because of these genetic events, those cells no longer die. Maybe they divide a little bit more, and over time they accumulate to the point where there's a tumor, and you know, in approximately 30,000 men each year, that those tumors spread and eventually cause the demise of the individual, and that's what we're fighting against. We're in a very exciting time because we now have technologies that can look at tumors, prostate tumors, as well as other cancers, and use what we call next-generation sequencing to understand every genetic change in the cells, in the cancer cells, so that we can really build a full blueprint of cancer, if you will. And what has happened over the past 5 years is that these technologies have been applied to prostate cancer, and we have developed what I would call a catalog of genetic changes in prostate cancers that are common, that we see frequently. And the future goal is to use that catalog to both guide our therapies and improve the care. So let's talk a little bit about that catalog. What we found out over the past 5 to 10 years, and this reflects, you know, decades of research that preceded this, But we have found that there are some common molecular events that are really important in prostate cancer. One, Susan's already mentioned the androgen receptor. So this is a protein that is in every prostate epithelial cell that basically helps that cell change what genes are turned on and what are turned off. What we now know is androgen receptor is the key driver of prostate cancer, both cancer that's first diagnosed as well as cancer that has spread and is now growing despite primary hormonal therapy. And it's really been over the past 5 to 10 years that we've realized that even in men with metastatic prostate cancer, whose disease is now progressing despite primary hormonal therapy, the androgen receptor is still active. And that understanding has led to the development of the drugs that Susan mentioned, like abiraterone or enzalutamide, and those drugs target the androgen receptor. And the success of those drugs are due to the fact that most cancers still care a great deal about androgen receptor. Well, we found some other genetic and molecular events that are common. One are, there's a lot of prostate cancers make new genes. We call them fusions. This is where a cancer cell takes part of one gene and combines it with another gene to get a novel protein. And almost 60% of prostate tumors do this with a family of proteins. They're called the ETS family member. That's not as important, but what's important to know is these are also transcription factors like androgen receptor, and they're very common. And this is, right now we don't have a therapy to target those, but we know that targeting those are likely to result in a further breakthroughs. What's also been interesting is that together with genetic events that are common to prostate cancer, or specific to prostate cancer, there are a lot of events in prostate cancer that are shared with breast cancer, with colon cancer, and with other types of cancers. And I don't want to go through the alphabet soup of all the genetic changes, but that provides opportunity where maybe some men with prostate cancer should be looked at similarly to some patients with lung cancer or women with breast cancer because they share some of the genetics of the disease. So bottom line there is we understand the catalog of what prostate cancer is in the genetics. Now, the question is, okay, we have the catalog. How do we understand what each individual, what their tumors has as far as genetic events, and how do we use that? So the diagnostic technologies that we have are very much aimed at understanding what are the genetic events, what are the signaling pathways that these tumor cells are using to grow. So in prostate cancer, everybody knows about PSA, and you can't talk about molecular diagnostics in prostate cancer without talking about PSA. PSA is much maligned, but we use it extensively to understand how a man with prostate cancer, how we're doing with respect to treatment, and if that disease is progressing and whether we need to change treatment. We also have other markers that are available that are diagnostic that are being used. One is a urine-based marker called PCA3. This is not a protein. This is RNA. But it's being used in men who have a high PSA and are at risk for having disease in their prostate. Perhaps the biopsies are negative. This PCA3 test from the urine can give a urologist a better understanding as well. The first set of biopsies were negative, but maybe if I repeat biopsies, there would be cancer. Obviously, we should minimize how many biopsies men have because they're uncomfortable and there's a risk of infection. PCA3 helps understand what is the risk of us having missed a cancer with negative biopsies. And then another diagnostic that is available that's not tissue-based is circulating tumor cells. So for men with more advanced disease, what we're finding out is when a man has metastatic prostate cancer, frequently there are prostate cancer cells circulating in the blood. Now, the number of these cells is relatively small compared to all the blood cells. So it may be 1 in a million, 1 in 10 million, 1 in 100 million cells. But we are now having technologies where we can find those cells and we can characterize how many there are. And right now the test that men can have is a circulating tumor cell test that will tell you how many cells, circulating tumor cells, a man might have. That's been important because we know if a man starts therapy, a new therapy, regardless of what therapy it is, be it chemotherapy or therapy targeting the androgen receptor, if their number of CTCs, circulating tumor cells, drops on that therapy, that's a very good sign that man will have a significant benefit from that therapy. Now, those are out there now, and I am hopeful that we'll have many more. I want to make a distinction. As we look forward, we're saying, okay, what are some tissue-based markers that may be available? That means where, in order to understand a man's disease, we need a piece of the tumor, whether that's done through a prostate biopsy if we're looking localized disease, or more and more, we're asking men to have biopsies of metastatic disease. That is not standard of care yet. But as we need to know more about each individual's tumor, we're going to be asking more men to perform these metastatic disease, and there's a lot of us who are trying to figure out how to do that effectively with minimal discomfort and extract the most information out of those biopsies to help men with disease. So that gets to the idea of personalized medicine and using diagnosis to help guide therapy. So there, I want to talk about two specific settings. One is localized disease. And Susan covered very well the different options that men face when they are first diagnosed. And we know that with the advent of PSA screening, and we know that the U.S. Preventive Task Force is not supportive, and now the American College of Physicians are non-supportive. I am supportive of PSA testing. I feel it has decreased mortality due to prostate cancer. I think the challenge with PSAT is more of that we diagnose a lot of men with prostate cancer that will never affect their lives. So this is prostate cancer that's in their prostate that if we didn't have PSA, they would be never diagnosed and it would never cause them any harm, either in their symptoms when they're urinating or just their longevity. And so what we really need is that we need better tests so when a man does get diagnosed, we have a way to say, does this man need to have surgery or radiation, or does this should this man pursue active surveillance? And what I'll say is that when we look at the numbers and we look at the characteristics of tumors that are diagnosed, we feel that fully half of men who are diagnosed should follow an active surveillance where, as Susan said, they're followed very closely, but they are not treated right away with surgery or radiation. And we're showing that safe if you have the right type of tumor. Well, right now we have PSA, we have pathology and something called the Gleason score, and we have the physical exam and some imaging. There are emerging tests that look at the molecular kind of profile of those tumors. And so many of you may be familiar with a breast cancer test called the Oncotype DX performed by Genomic Health. Genomic Health will be launching next week, you may see it in the news, a test for prostate called Oncotype DX for prostate. It's called GPS, actually, for prostate. And that test helps men with that decision whether they should seek treatment or whether they should be on active surveillance. There's another company called Myriad Genetics that is known for their testing of BRCA1 and BRCA2. They have another test called the Prolaris that also can help in that decision. And those are the beginnings, and I'm hoping that more and more will be able to support men in that decision based on not only on the PSA and the pathology, but based on a real understanding of the molecular characteristics of their tumor. And I think that where right now only 14% of men in our nation choose active surveillance, hopefully with molecular insight, we'll be able to help more men and their families choose active surveillance rather than a definitive local therapy, which can lead to a lot of morbidity. So the other situation where we need more help in choosing therapy is metastatic disease. As I said, we're already doing more biopsies, but that's not being done or used clinically just yet. We are obtaining these circulating tumor cells, and it's very exciting that more and more we're starting to see that right now we use the number of circulating tumor cells to understand if a man's benefiting from therapy. So if they go down, it seems like the man is benefiting more. However, there's some early research that's coming out that says not only can you look at the number of circulating tumor cells, but you can look at the molecular events in those circulating tumor cells and look at how they behave during therapy in order to make the best decisions for what therapy that man should receive. And over time, what we'll be doing more and more is that we're going to bring together this catalog of genetic events in prostate cancer that we now have built the catalog. We're going to be using biopsies from tissue, local and metastatic, and what we would call a liquid biopsy, where we draw blood which would obviously be much preferred other than the procedures. And we'll bring that together with our growing armamentarium of treatments to make sure that each man gets the right therapy for the disease at the right time to, you know, slow the progression of disease and hopefully cure more men with this disease. Finally, I just want to mention that, and we'll talk about this a little bit more, that this is, and Susan touched upon this, the decisions as far as what tests to have, how to interpret those tests, and what therapies are most useful for each individual does require a team approach. Each man with prostate cancer and their support system and loved ones have to speak with their physician, be it a urologist, medical oncologist, radiation oncologist, and their physicians have to talk together to make sure we use all our molecular insight to improve care. And I think I'll stop there, and hopefully we'll have more questions later.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Febbo. That was an excellent presentation and really very informative, and lots of information about areas that many of our audience may not be as familiar with. So I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. And our next speaker is Carly Mesovitz, and Carly is an oncology social worker at Cancer Care, and she is going to address the free psychosocial services that you can access from Cancer Care, as well as talk about prostate cancer support groups and their important role. It's my pleasure to turn the program over to my colleague, Carly.
Thanks, Carolyn. It's a pleasure to be a part of this call today. I'd like to start by speaking about the importance of creating a support network when you're diagnosed with cancer and how Cancer Care can be a part of that network. There are a lot of ways that we can help. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Cancer Care programs include individual counseling, support groups, education about resources and how to navigate the healthcare system, practical help, and some limited financial assistance. All of our services are delivered by master's level oncology social workers and are completely free of charge. Oncology social workers are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends, and we're experienced in helping people to manage the emotional, physical, and financial challenges that arise after a diagnosis. Adjusting to and dealing with the diagnosis itself is an important part of the healing process. Asking for help by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker for counseling is really a sign of strength. Cancer Care offers face-to-face groups in our local offices in the New York area, and we also offer telephone and online groups. These groups offer you a unique opportunity to connect with other people impacted by cancer, along with the help of a Cancer Care social worker to facilitate the group. Sharing information and understanding with others in similar situations can be quite a powerful experience. Group members offer encouragement and a sense of community that can really provide you with an additional support and guidance. These connections can really help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience. At this time, Cancer Care offers an online support group for men living with prostate cancer. We're currently recruiting for a new cycle of this 15-week support group, and that will begin this June. If you're interested in participating in this group or have any questions, please call our counseling and information line at 1-800-813-4673 or visit our website at www.cancercare.org to register. As we've all learned from today's program, there's a lot of information to digest and make sense of. Our social workers can help you understand what this all means for you and for your family. A Cancer Care social worker can help you prioritize and consider the questions that you might want to ask so that you get the answers and the information that you need. So just remember that you're not alone in this. Cancer Care services are there to help you. So again, please contact us at 1-800-813-HOPE, that's 4673, or log on to our website at www.cancercare.org for more information about our oncology social work support. I thank you all for your time and attention and for the opportunity to talk with you all today. And I'll go ahead and pass things back to Carolyn.
Well, thank you very much, Carly. That was wonderful and giving everyone an idea of all the services. And we do have that's wonderful groups that we have and an online support group. And if you're interested, just go ahead and contact us. We'd happy to have you participate. So now we have time for questions. We actually have a lot of time for questions. I'm going to ask Stephanie to explain to everybody how to queue up for questions and to bring all of our speakers on board. We'll take your questions one at a time, and if we don't get your question, just call Cancer Care at the end of the call at 1-800-813-4673, and I'll repeat that number again. But for right now, let's see if we can take most of your questions. Stephanie?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Our first question comes from Francis M. Your line is open.
Just curiosity, at what stage does circulating tumor cells become a subject of discussion? I think you used the word advanced disease. I've heard the term used before, but I'm not sure when they kind of roll into the mix. I guess that's the best way for me to ask the question.
Yep. An excellent question, Dr. Pepo, yes.
Yeah, so it's a very good question, and I know I didn't have time to go into it. So, you know, I want to start off by saying we believe that probably circulating tumor cells are present very early in a man's diagnosis with prostate cancer. Where it comes into the management of patients with prostate cancer now is in men with metastatic disease, so prostate cancer that has spread to the bones or to the lymph nodes in the abdomen or other places. When we look, and that's because the technology that's available now, when it's used to detect circulating tumor cells in men with local prostate cancer, is almost always fails to find tumor cells. And it's only when it's metastatic that we find tumor cells. However, there are investigators who have more sensitive ways to detect circulating tumor cells that are still research-based, but they're almost 100 to 1,000-fold more sensitive. And when they look at blood from men with localized disease, they do find cells. So with the commercial available test right now, the Veradex, that's only used in men with metastatic disease. As technology improves and the commercial availability of some of these more sensitive tests come online, that'll move earlier in disease.
Excellent. Thank you very much. That's a really excellent question and great response to it. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from John C. Your line is open.
Is that one that I had?
I'm John C. Go ahead.
Oh, John,
hello?
Your question? Hi. We'd be happy to take your question.
I was diagnosed with prostate cancer, and at first they talked about radiation treatment. But I have what they call essential tremors. So I couldn't hold still for the radiation treatment. So then they said surgery to remove it. But then now they're treating the essential tremors, and I've come back to the point I got to make a decision. And I don't have really any information one way or the other to make that decision, either radiation or surgery. And the one thing that worries me is committing for 9 weeks, 5 days a week for radiation. I don't know if I can commit to that.
John, you're really asking some excellent questions here. And we're going to answer your question in a general way, and we're going to hope that the information that is provided will help you to take that back to your healthcare team and help you with a decision. I'm going to ask Dr. Slovin if you would address it. And there are a couple of parts to your question, John. One is, in Dr. Slovin, if you'd like to address just the issue of having other health problems along with prostate cancer.
Sure.
And how that impacts
people. I mean, John, you have me at a disadvantage, unfortunately, because there's a lot of information that I don't know. Usually if somebody is referred for radiation, it could be because that they're older than age 70 or they have other medical problems. In your case, the essential tremor, although it's now well controlled from what you're telling me. I don't have a sense of the PSA, the Gleason score, and, you know, your overall medical condition. And frankly, you know, most people go to work when they are getting radiation. I mean, the whole procedure itself, in the beginning, you go through something called simulation, which is just a way that they are able to put your body in a particular position so that the radiation can occur, and they actually make a like a plaster mold of your lower body so that you don't move during the procedure. And that's the only time that really there's a huge commitment in terms of your own personal time. People usually go right before work or they go to after work, and it really has not held anybody back. It's 5 days a week, as you know, for those several weeks. Again, whether or not surgery would be better or not for you, again, I really can't tell you. I can tell you that surgery is very straightforward. The hospitalization time is usually 24 to 48 hours if it's done laparoscopically or robotically. And again, whether or not the survival is going to be any different, the answer is no, they're very comparable. But again, the side effect profiles are a little bit different between the two. There might be a little bit more stress incontinence with surgery compared with radiation. Both of them will have some impact on erectile function. But again, unfortunately, I just wish I could say do one or the other, but I just can't. What I would really strongly recommend is that if you don't have satisfaction, speaking to either the surgeon or, in other words, the urologist or the medical oncologist, I would ask them for a referral to a medical oncologist who can sit down with you and dissect out the pros and cons of each and would help you make the right decision. Again, I apologize that I can't be more helpful in this regard.
Well, I think that's very important. What you're saying is that really to sit down, actually, John, with your treating doctor and ask these questions. Also, Dr. Sullivan, in terms of the essential tremor, he would want to find out exactly how the tremor might impact the radiation if he's moving
towards. Well, exactly right. I mean, I think if John is correct in saying that it's being treated with medications, usually they give beta blockers, for example, and the tremor is no longer an issue, then certainly radiation would be very reasonable. But again, I don't know the situation. I don't know if the tremor was the only reason. But if it's under control, then he really should sit down with his doctor and say, look, I'm not able to make a decision. Can someone be a tiebreaker? And sometimes that's the role of the medical oncologist, to try to inform the patient of more of the details and put it into perspective than either the radiation doctor or the urologist alone can do.
And Dr. Sullivan, the broader, there's another issue here for everybody on the call.
Yes.
And if you could just, you have addressed it actually in part, but the issue of having another, when you have prostate cancer, sometimes people have other health problems. And
absolutely.
How do they coordinate, or just some guidelines
again,
for that coordination?
Very, very good point, Carolyn. I mean, you know, when we take care of patients, it's really a multidisciplinary approach. And the American Cancer Society recently has set up a major effort to try to inform primary care physicians and internists of how to best work with the medical oncologist, the radiation oncologist, the urologist, in really taking care of the patients. You are not alone in your medical problems because we don't see you just as a prostate. Clearly, we have to see you in terms of any other medical problems you may have, from heart issues to blood pressure to, you know, generalized well-being. And I think it's very, very important for your doctors at all levels, whether the urologist, radiation oncologist, or medical oncologist, speak with your primary care physician or whomever the physician of expertise is who is currently managing your case, for example, could be a neurologist, and just get a better idea of what's going on, because the one thing that we always want to do is talk doctor to doctor, because, you know, we're here to protect you, and we want to make sure that you have the right decision in going into a treatment plan than just doing it just because that's something we think you should do. Everybody wants to be on the same page, and I think coordinating your care with all these doctors, having a doctor be the lead and talking to the other doctors, it will definitely be in your benefit.
Excellent. Thank you. And I hope that helps everybody on the call because that's often an issue, and it really helps to have those, you know, to have that discussion with your doctor, also with the doctor who's treating you with your other health problems. They all, as Dr. Sullivan has said, talk together. So, John, thank you for those questions. I hope this is helpful to you. And, you know, please call us at Cancer Care 2 for some more just one-to-one discussion with you about some of your concerns, about the questions you should ask, and how you can work with your healthcare team to get the best care possible. And I think we have another question, Stephanie.
Our next question comes from Clark R. Your line is open.
Yes. I have a question concerning the CTC results. I've read some that five or above a CT count is getting to an extreme. And I want to know exactly what the numbers mean as far as treatment modalities and overall survival.
So this is Dr. Febo. So five is the number. So whenever you develop a diagnostic test, most of the time you're measuring something that has a distribution, meaning it has a spread of values. And seldom are humans very straightforward as far as you're either one or the other. I mean, sex is one, that's easy, male or female. But most of the biomarkers are a distribution, and CTCs follow that. So there is a range of CTCs using this Veradex from zero to as many as several thousands. And what that number is how many circulating tumor cells, CTCs, are detected in 7.5 mLs of blood. Five has been the number, the cutoff, that has been associated in studies where if men who have more than five circulating tumor cells tend to have a worse outcome than men with fewer. And that's a snapshot, and you really have no control over how many circulating tumor cells your tumor produces. But that value has also been used as far as evaluating therapy. And so what has been shown consistently, and this is from colleagues of Susan at Memorial, is that if you have more than five circulating tumor cells in your blood and you start a therapy, and the next month, a month into starting that therapy, you check your circulating tumor cells, and now those have dropped below five, that's a very good sign that you're going to have a meaningful response to therapy. So I think the bottom line is circulating tumor cells as a snapshot, as far as the number that your tumor produces and remain in the blood, gives you some information about perhaps how much tumor you have or the proclivity of your tumor to have cells into the circulating tumor cell into circulation. What's more informative is how those circulating tumor cell numbers change when you start a new therapy. And that's where I think we're getting better at saying, let's try this therapy. If we don't see a drop, there's a chance that you may want to switch therapies because you're anticipating that it's not as helpful, and there may be another therapy that's more helpful. So it's the dynamics that are really important to understand.
I would just add, this is Dr. Slovin, I would just add one little piece of information. That is, we've often found PSA not to be the most reliable indicator for patients who have a very high volume of disease. Sometimes with response to therapy, as Phil just mentioned, the PSA, circulating tumor cells may go down, but the PSA may stay stable or even rise a little bit. So really the idea behind the circulating tumor cells is that we think that it is likely to be more reflective of a change in the biology of the cancer compared with the way the PSA does. PSA is like Dow Jones, it goes up and down and may not be necessarily reflective of the actual biology, but it could also be reflective of cell death. So that's, I think, a very important reason that we are looking at circulating tumor cells. And please keep in mind, it's still not been 100% validated as yet as a major marker. We're looking toward the results of several very large phase 3 trials to get the information to tell us whether or not this is really going to be as useful as we believe it to be.
Excellent. We have another question from one of our online participants, Julie. Can you explain the difference between castration-resistant prostate cancer and locally advanced? Dr. Slovin?
Locally advanced usually implies the cancer at the time of diagnosis that is beyond the confines of the gland itself. When we talk about localized prostate cancer, we're talking about cancer that is usually confined to the prostate, maybe even as much as the capsule itself. Locally advanced usually implies that the cancer is either in the seminal vesicles or may be into neighboring structures, such as the neurovascular bundle that harbors the nerve, the artery, and the vein, or it could even be in the lymph nodes that are very close to the prostate itself. So does it mean that the treatment will necessarily be changed? One still could do surgery in cases of locally advanced disease. Again, it just depends on the extent of it.
Now, there's a question here for both Dr. Slofen and Dr. Febbo, and the question is, the current treatments are for adenocarcinomas. Do you think a change in histological TRCA, more neuroendocrine, will change over time with exposure to newer agents? Thank you.
So, Susan, I can start. We are seeing with, so it's a very good question, and there is, a phenotype, a characteristics of patients with advanced castration-resistant prostate cancer where the tumor takes on different characteristics that are more like what we call neuroendocrine cells than typical prostate epithelial cells. And what we're seeing is that as we get more effective therapies that strongly target the androgen receptor, like abiraterone and enzalutamide, we're seeing a shift in the number of men who eventually progress with disease that looks neuroendocrine. And these types of tumors tend to no longer respond as well to androgen receptor-targeted therapies. The good news is we're starting to understand the genetics of these tumors. And we also know clinically that these tumors tend to respond to different types of therapies better than prostate, typical prostate adenocarcinoma. One example is a type of chemotherapy called platinums, which are used across different types of tumors, whereas these men with more neuroendocrine tumors tend to respond much better to that type of chemotherapy. And there are some novel targeted agents that are in development in other diseases that can specifically target some of the molecular changes we see in these tumors. And so there's some trials that are starting up to see if a new class of therapies for these men. So I think the question is, we are seeing more men. We've always seen men with neuroendocrine tumors. We're seeing more men with the more effective therapies we have against the androgen receptor therapies. We have a good understanding of some of the molecular events that are in there, and we have different. We have both established and some emerging therapies to help those men, too.
I think Phil is absolutely correct. I mean, we're in a very different world when it comes to neuroendocrine. We used to be very nervous when we saw this. But one thing I would point out is sometimes the PSA is not the most reliable indicator of a neuroendocrine tumor. Sometimes we're able to follow certain markers in the blood called chromogranin or CEA or synaptophysin, just to give you an idea that we can monitor the response of the tumor just based on looking at those. Not every tumor produces those, but it's not always a PSA-dependent condition.
And we have another question. Can you speak to the relationship of the BRCA genes in prostate cancer?
Sure. So the BRCA genes, so these are the breast cancer genes that are associated with familial syndromes in women of breast and breast and ovarian cancer. And in fact, in families that have an inherited mutation in BRCA2, there is an increased risk of prostate cancer. And this kind of plays into what we were just talking about with the neuroendocrine, in that men who develop prostate cancer and who come from a BRCA mutation family, who are BRCA carriers, mutant carriers, tend to have prostate cancers that are less responsive to hormonal therapy. They tend to have very short response to hormonal therapy and tend to behave more like, are more sensitive to these same platinum agents. And, you know, we're hoping they may be more sensitive to drugs that are in development that also target DNA repair, which are frequently called PARP inhibitors, which is a way to inhibit, to kind of prevent DNA repair. And so BRCA2 mutants specifically are associated with an increased family risk of prostate cancer in a man. What we're also seeing is that when we look at the sequence, when we apply next generation sequencing to men who are who just have prostate cancer and don't have a strong family history, is 3 to 4% of men with prostate cancer actually have mutations in BRCA1 or BRCA2 in their tumors too. And so this is going to be an area where there's probably, even though it's a small percentage of men, we have emerging therapies that could very effectively target those men. So either a family history or sporadic development of mutation, I think it's going to be, we're going to move towards where there's a subgroup of men that we choose therapy based on that, the disruption of BRCA, where there could be very effective therapy.
Thank you. And there's one other question. The question is, you mentioned recommending clinical trials early in biochemical relapse. Can you highlight any such trials ongoing currently? Dr. Slovin, could you address this in a general way?
Yes. I mean, there are any number of institutions that have trials. At Memorial, we have a trial looking at starting treatment with abiraterone very early on in concert with a anti-CTLA-4 monoclonal antibody. It's sort of a combination of immune. It's for patients whose cancer has come back, you know, rising PSAs. Again, it's not for everyone. Unfortunately, there really is no standard of care. I myself am not a lover of starting any therapy for someone who has a rising PSA. In fact, for many years, I have just been using single-agent anti-androgens on an intermittent basis for many of our patients, and they've done very well. Again, unfortunately, this is a unique population for which we are really trying to develop novel therapies. It's in one particular case, this is probably an excellent population for whom Cipolucil-T by, you know, Dendrion might be a very reasonable approach, albeit it's not indicated for there as yet. So we're working on it, is all I can tell you, and hopefully, you know, by the time we have another call, something will have popped up in that area.
Well, thank you very much. I want to thank both of our speakers. You've just been extraordinary, and just this amazing call today, I have to say. And we definitely will. There are more of these calls coming up. But this particular topic, we would hope to be able to do more often, actually. And I also want to thank all of you who've either asked questions on the phone or online that really enhanced the call today. Now, I do want to remind you it's a one-hour program and that we know you have many needs that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour. And I want you to know that you can contact Cancer Care at any time, and Carly had reviewed the services we offer. You can call us at 1-800-813-HOPE, and those services include practical and financial assistance, counseling, and we are starting a wonderful online prostate cancer support group, so look into that as well if that's something that might be of interest to you. And we also have all types of programs like this. Indeed, there is a part 2 and 3 to this program. So part 2 of this program is on May 24th, and it's Advances in the Treatment of Metastatic Prostate Cancer. And part 3 actually will be addressing the needs of caregivers and for caregivers coping with a loved one's metastatic prostate cancer on June 11th. So stay tuned. There's more programs coming up and lots more on this particular topic because it's really an important one. Most importantly, as we conclude today, I don't want anyone to think that you're alone in coping with prostate cancer or with cancer in general. I want you to know that you're part of this community of support, and you can call us at any time at 1-800-813-HOPE. I want to thank you for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect and have a wonderful day.